before Superfly flew, before Shaft got shafted, before Dolomite went out of sight, there was Paleo Cinema. Hello and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast number 37. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around, on the second anniversary of the podcast, I am looking at blaxploitation again. Already did Shaft earlier in one of the earlier podcasts. This time around, I'm getting into the heart of, if you'll excuse the expression, darkness. I'm looking at three films: Dolomite, the Rudy Ray Moore blaxploitation spoof satire, but not quite. The sequel to it, The Human Tornado, and one of the blaxploitation films that was kind of a parody or a pastiche or a reiteration of a white movie. In this case, it's Black Shampoo, the black version of Warren Beatty's very famous and very popular movie Shampoo. I'll let Sal do the introductions and we'll get into it and we'll get some blaxploitation happening here.
Paleo Cinema is a three-weekly podcast that looks at film noir, horror, cult movies, classic films, science fiction, and other genre works from 1895 to 1980. The email address is cultguru@gmail.com, cultguru@gmail.com. So please send comments, feedback, and MP3 voicemails to that address. The blog for the podcast, which has lots of extra content relating to each episode, is paleo-cinema.blogspot.com. This podcast contains adult content and occasional swearing, so don't lend your MP3 player to children.
Before we go any further, I've really got to say this again, that Sally's been really supportive and wonderful regarding the podcast over the full 2 years. 2 years haven't always been good ones in our lives. There have been some hassles, and I did have the depression things and stuff like that, and she saw me through it, and she was very supportive of me using this podcast as a way of reaching out to people, dealing with the issues I had to deal with, and sharing my love of movies in a quite a novel way. So thanks very much for that, Sal. But getting on with the podcast, what else have I been doing? I've watched a few movies. I saw Murder, My Sweet with Dick Powell in it, the adaptation of the Raymond Chandler novel, one of the two best Philip Marlowe's in movie history, Dick Powell, the other one, of course, being Robert Mitchum. And I've been getting deep into the heart of blaxploitation, not only the movies I'm going to talk about today, but I've watched a few other ones as well, and even watched Rudy Ray Moore's third movie, Disco Godfather, which is not his best work, but has a kind of trashy time and place in history kind of feel about it that makes it at least worth a little bit of a watch. Been watching a little bit of TV as well, but in general, just chilling out, getting through the end of winter and the beginning of spring. Weather's starting to warm up here, the sun's coming out a lot more, and the birds are singing as the trees grow flowers on them. I did get some feedback. I'll just read a couple of pieces that I got from some of the Paleo Cinema fans out there. David Munn, the only person ever to put an audio mail out to Paleo Cinema and have it played on the podcast. And by the way, that is a hint to everybody else. David sent me an email regarding the science fiction episode I did a couple of episodes ago. And I'll just read that for you now. David starts by talking about The Day of the Earth, which is one of the films I watched in the podcast, and he says, "Hi, Terry. It's a very long time since I last watched The Day the Earth Stood Still, but I thought the ultimatum that was put to the humans was to either accept robot masters who would kill anyone who acted aggressively towards others, or to have the Earth destroyed rather than that the Earth would be destroyed if anyone acted aggressively. Whether it will be oppressive to have robot masters is a difficult question. Anthony Burgess, who used the principle that violence freely chosen is better than enforced peace as the theme of A Clockwork Orange, probably would have said that it is. But when you think about it, how many of us feel that it's an intolerable infringement of our freedom that we can't rape a woman without being sent to jail? The thing with robot masters is they are impartial and, one assumes, infallible. they only kill the person who attacks someone else, and they always kill them, and they know that they are the ones who acted in that way. Miscarriages of justice and the law's delay are removed. What isn't clear, though, is the psychological effect of knowing that one will be killed if one attacks another. Clatu says that the knowledge is enough to stop the action, but does that knowledge also have a subtler effect on self-esteem and freedom of expression? And is it only physical violence that the robots respond to? What about verbal abuse, which might provoke the other person to be violent? One thing I wonder about is when you played that clip as to whether the scriptwriter had in mind the Cold War theory of mutually assured destruction when writing about the results of violent action being unthinkable. If the destruction of the planet due to one person's action is what's being threatened, in a way, that is what we already have during the Cold War. And like you, I'm a big fan of the short story. Actually, you bring up some good points there, David. I think the big logical fallacy in The Day the Earth Stood Still is the fact that they assume that violence is premeditated, that it's not just a spontaneous act under pressure. And we know from any number of murder cases at various times, people have struck out. I mean, Herman Melville's Billy Budd was totally about a young man put under intolerable pressure, striking out once out of that repressed rage and anger and hurt and frustration. I think that the whole concept is a bit simplistic in that film, in that it assumes that a premeditation to any acts of violence that occur, and in an overwhelming number of cases, well, not overwhelming number, but in a great number of cases, violence is not premeditated, violence is spontaneous. And I don't think that this kind of a film, the concept of the film, really lends itself to being looked at too closely because of that. If you get drunk, what if somebody gets a mental illness and becomes violent? What if somebody has an undiagnosed brain tumour and becomes violent? What if somebody bumps their head and in disorientation strikes out at somebody else when they come to help them? I mean, it's a very simplistic kind of worldview. It doesn't take into account the nuances. And I think that's a big problem I have with the whole concept of robot policemen. I don't think that they've got the ability to temper the law with mercy the way that human beings have. All too often we don't, and that is an indictment of us. But I think that we're better off having fallible laws which allow wiggle room in righteous cases than have laws which are draconian in the same way Sharia law is. That really just have one setting for every broad circumstance. So, but you bring up great points there, and please, I mean, I'm always willing to have a chat about this stuff. David also goes on to say, 2001 A Space Odyssey is a much better novel than it is a movie. Arthur C. Clarke's book, although based on the movie script rather than the other way around, is a very powerful story, and it works in a way the movie can't by explaining what the characters are thinking, giving a God's eye view account of everything and leaving the visuals up to our imaginations. The strong points of the film are the Dawn of Man sequence, which still stands up well, and the matching of visuals to classical music. The Stargate sequence is dated the most, looking as it does like a psychedelic rock club night light show. Having said all that, I still do like the film a lot. I just don't think it's the masterpiece many consider it to be. We'll disagree on that, David, and that's perfectly fine that we do. I think that the movie has dated very badly, and I think that originally it was way overrated. I think there were any number of other science fiction films, much smaller budget, much less hype, some of which I've talked about in the podcast, which are much better science fiction films and which stand up better as entertainment. And remember, movies are entertainment as well than 2001 does. I mean, a movie like The Power is great. A movie like Colossus, The Forbin Project is great. And they're both good, solid science fiction. Privileged, Peter Watkins' film is another one. There are any number, late 1960s did produce good science fiction films, but I don't really think that 2001 A Space Odyssey is one of them. People do have a fondness for it, and I accept that, but having watched it recently, and I didn't really see it until probably the 1980s originally, it's not one of my favourites, and I think that it's a very flawed piece of work. But David ends with talking about some of the music that I played in the podcast. He says, your playing of the theme from Who Killed Teddy Bear inspired me to buy Josie Cotton's Invasion of the B-Girls album on eMusic. I just finished listening to it and I love it. I've always loved the Man-Eaters theme from She-Devils on Wheels, and she does a great version of it Goodbye Godzilla was also great. Cheers, David. I haven't got the album. I've been trying to find it, and I may well end up actually forking out money to get it at some stage. But, yeah, I do like Jesse Cotton's spin on B-movie soundtracks. And, again, I've got to thank Vince Rotolo for putting me on to Jesse Cotton's stuff. He did play Who Killed Teddy Bear on his podcast, and it was just a great piece of work. Thanks for tipping me off to that, Vince. Okay, moving right along to the next letter, or next email at least, letters being a 20th century concept, of course. I'm not sure when the last time I received a letter was. This one's from Rickster, who has been kind enough to send it to me. Okay, hi Terry, still having a tough time organising myself around my overnight shift, but I wanted to have a few moments and write you about the podcast. Obviously, I've been listening to each one intently and enjoy them as always. I did, however, find the review about your podcast silly in the extreme. I think he's talking about that one that's on Extreme Edgy Reviews or whatever it was, i.e. about your voice being monotonous. What are you supposed to do, sing? I could, but I'd lose audience. I mean, really, this is a podcast in which you talk about movies, so unless you're going to conduct it as if you're reading a children's bedtime story, I can't see how else you're supposed to talk. You've got a great radio voice, and you shouldn't change a thing. Regarding the three featured films in your latest podcast, you know already that A Canterbury Tale is one of my favourite films of all time. I'm not sure why exactly, other than what I wrote about it in my blog about a year ago. Your piece on the film was much appreciated, and hopefully will bring A Canterbury Tale more notice as a result. Must admit to never having even heard of The Shout, but now I'm extremely interested in seeking out a copy. Sounds interesting. As for The Asphyx, I remember seeing that on VHS when I was a kid, and not particularly liking it. I didn't dislike it either. Perhaps in my teenage years it was a bit slow moving for me. I've since rewatched movies I didn't think that much of when I saw them as a youngster, Casablanca being one of them, shockingly, and found that now I really love them. Casablanca is now my third favourite film of all time. So you can rest assured that if an opportunity to rewatch The Asphyx comes along, I'll jump at it faster than a tingler and a teenager's took us. That's about it for the email. Keep up the good work. And as always, I'll be listening to each new podcast with keen anticipation. Warm regards, Rickster. Thanks for that, Rickster. Yeah, there are some movies that you see as a kid and you really don't get into, but later on you do as an adult. I can't really, off the top of my head, think of any that I had that reaction to. I know movies that I did watch and like as a kid I can't watch now. I did suffer through a lot of Elvis Presley movies in the 1960s when I was going to Saturday matinees. They were always double featured with something I did want to see, so that wasn't too bad. But that sort of film now puts me off. They're silly and simplistic, and unless they've got Anne Margaret in them, there's no features of interest for me. But, yeah, I do understand that. Do look around. There are a number of sites. There are some of them which have links to rapid share copies of films. I won't go into too much detail about that because you need invites to get into some of them, and I don't have any to spare, to be really honest with you. But if you look around, there may be possibilities of finding some of these films which aren't otherwise available from less than legal methods. But that's about it for the feedback. I did get a few comments and little bits and pieces from Facebook, but I haven't been smart enough to collate them. Next time I'm going to cut and paste them into a document. And so please, if you want to contact me on Facebook and leave a comment, I will in future cut and paste them and feed them back through the podcast, but at the moment I haven't done that. Okay, it's time to actually talk about the films.
Yo, Terry, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I'm going to let you finish. And I'm happy for you on your second anniversary podcast. But Beyonce, she have one of the best podcasts of all time. All time.
Thank you for that, Sal. And thank you for being so topical with the Kanye West reference. I appreciate that. And I do appreciate all your help over the last 2 years.
You're very welcome. And congratulations. And hope it's a good show for you.
Thank you. Catch you later.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay, this time for sure we're going to get into the movies, and thanks to Sal for that piece of topical humour that she threw in a few minutes ago for me. Okay, first film I'm going to talk about is Dolomite, the Rudy Ray Moore pimp gangster crime movie. Now, I'll get a précis of the film from the website of Rudy Ray Moore. Unfortunately, he died last year, but his website is still going. But first, I'm going to play the theme from Dolomite.
Some folks say that Willie Breed was the baddest motherfucker the world ever seen. But I want you to hold on to your seat. Hold on to them tight. Cause you now get ready to see the story of me. Yes, me, the badass. Double the mic.
Oh, he's bad.
The movie was directed by Derville Martin in 1974, stars Rudy Ray Moore, and here is the synopsis. Dolomite is released from prison after being framed in order to help the police catch Willie Green, played by Derville Martin, and stop the drug trafficking in town. Dolomite's club has been taken over by Green with the help of Lady B and her kung fu fighting girls. He gets his club back. We learn the mayor is the backbone to Green's organisation, and undercover cop officer Pete Blakely, Jerry Jones, helps Dolomite put an end to their operations. Okay, Jerry Jones also wrote the script for the film. So Dolomite is, it's indescribable, you've got to see it really, but I'm going to try to describe it anyway because that's what the podcast is all about. I don't know why it works. I'll be honest with you, I don't really know why Dolomite works as an entertainment. Rudy Ray Moore is not a good actor. And most of the others, with possible exception of Jerry Jones, who is a professional actor and is still alive and has worked in the last few years, the rest of them are not good actors. The only time where Dolomite as a character really comes alive is when in a nightclub and in the street he does a couple of Rudy Ray Moore's nightclub acts. They do Shine on the Titanic, and they also do Signify and Monkey, which were two of Rudy Ray Moore's shouts, or they were rapping dialogues that he did as a part of his nightclub act. And ongoing in his career, he did a number of comedy records, and that's how he started out in the business. He did blue comedy, and he could be quite raw and quite explicit in the things he said in his nightclub act. I'll just give you a little bit of a sample.
I'm here to clear all doubts. I'm here to tell you what good fucking is all about. Ladies, fucking is not a game, it's an art. When you do it, girls, you gotta do it with all your heart. All right. Ladies, you don't have to be down under. Make your man think he's been struck by lightning and moved by thunder. And when your pussy begin to pop... Young man, can you make a pussy pop?
Oh, yeah, every day.
You gotta have dick to make a pussy pop, baby. You get a...
So you can see we aren't talking about Christian stand-up comedy here. Rudy Ray Moore was raw and honest about sexuality, let's say, and it does come across in the Dolomite films. It's the fight scenes aren't particularly good, even though some of it was choreographed by Chuck Norris's karate school back in the 1970s, and this was not too long after Chuck Norris made Way of the Dragon with Bruce Lee, so there was some credibility to having Chuck Norris's name somewhere in the credits. But Rudy Ray Moore does not move gracefully, I'll be honest with you. The fight scenes are hilarious in their ineptitude. they're really bad. There's some seriously ugly people in this film. I'm not talking about the girls. There are some great-looking girls in there. And they've got that nice, refreshing 1970s thing of being, let us say, all natural and all biodegradable women. There are no pieces of internal scaffolding placed in there by Beverly Hills surgeons. But Dolomite does... but Dolomite came along later in Blaxploitation. Blaxploitation really kind of started in the very late 60s and maybe early 1970s with Sweetback's badass song, Melvin Van Peebles' movie, along with Cotton Comes to Harlem, which was another film based on the Coffin, Ed, and Gravedigger books of Chester Himes. And then MGM got on board with Shaft and really kind of made it hit the big time around 1971. This one's like 3 years later. And it's kind of at the peak of Blaxploitation, heading towards the downslope. Blaxploitation only really lasted maybe 6-7 years at the most. And there were some really interesting sociological reasons why. Basically, it got mugged by vested interest groups in the black community and also among the white community. I'll just go into a bit of that for you because it's interesting to see how that occurred. I copped a hell of a lot of shit in its day, Blaxploitation. Some people hated the graphic violence, and to be honest with you, sex was rather mild, but it was very confronting to people in those days. Some black community groups claimed that it stereotyped black Americans. There was even a coalition against Blaxploitation formed by the NAACP, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, the Urban League, and a number of black film professionals who obviously weren't getting work in Blaxploitation films. According to some of the sources that I've found, the pressure brought by these groups is what killed Blaxploitation eventually. Now, I'll just quote a little bit from the contrary viewpoint. A journalist called Stephen Whitty did an article a couple of years ago about Blaxploitation, and he talked to a few people about it. He talked to Fred Williamson, who took control of his own projects quite early. In fact, the original Inglourious Basterds was a Fred Williamson movie. And Fred Williamson said, "Who was being exploited? Certainly not me." Others saw the unfair racial aspects of it. Director Oscar Williams asked, "Why wasn't Death Wish seen as white exploitation? How come the films for African Americans were singled out as being sexist and violent when there are any number of films made by mainstream white filmmakers that were at least as sexist and exploitative as the Blaxploitation movies?" It was like a cultural cringe about the fact that these films were being made by and predominantly for black audiences. Stephen Whitty goes on to say that African Americans playing brilliant doctors marrying into Katharine Hepburn's family were one thing, but flashy, trashy B-movies that had superfly drug dealers as their heroes was something else. And, you know, basically Blaxploitation was knocked on its ass by pressure from various groups in the community, which is a bit sad. I think that if you're going to address things, address real issues, address the poverty, address the lack of education, don't go after the soft targets of movies that people enjoy watching to make yourself feel better about actually doing something about a problem. So anyway, that's one of the reasons why Blaxploitation, not too long after Dolomite and The Human Tornado, the sequel, came out. This is the reasons why these films were no longer being made after about 1980. Even Ozploitation in Australia lasted a lot longer than that. Ozploitation went from the late 60s until the mid-late 80s, so they had a good 20 year run, whereas Blaxploitation could be encapsulated pretty much within the 1970s. And I think that's not a good thing. I think that, if nothing else, a movie of any kind trains people how to make movies. I mean, there are any number of technicians and actors, producers, writers, directors, lighting people who are trained in how to make films by being in exploitation movies. The third movie I'm going to talk about today, Black Shampoo, the director of cinematography won an Oscar. Not for that film, but eventually he did win an Oscar. So I won't go too much into that yet. But I think Blaxploitation movies And Dolomite is very much in that genre, even though it does take the piss out of it, were undervalued at the time they were being made. They weren't given any respect at all, even if only for getting people in work and getting people training. But moving on, Dolomite character is... He's hard to nail down. I mean, they've got Rudy Ray Moore doing the nightclub shtick, and Dolomite, he doesn't come across as a presence except when he's doing that nightclub stuff. It's amazing how the film works. I'm sure there are people who were familiar with his work beforehand who love seeing Rudy Ray Moore in a movie, but I don't really think that it comes across to somebody not familiar with his work quite as well. I do enjoy the films, and I've watched them a couple of times now. And I think they're silly and fun, but there are blaxploitation movies I like more, maybe because they take themselves more seriously. I think the Rudy Ray Moore ones have a charm that comes from the fact that they're inept and you can see microphone booms in the top of the screen at times and all of those sorts of bits and pieces that movie buffs look for. But the first Dolomite film is probably the weakest of the Rudy Ray Moore movies. Even when the third of his movies that I saw, Disco Godfather, goes into long rants about the problems of angel dust and the community and things like that, it's Dolomite still suffers in comparison to it because it's not as much, it's not as cohesive. It seems to be episodic and it seems to be little bits and pieces of stuff. And I realise that that's budgetary and it's not always within the control of the filmmakers, but that's the 1970s for you. People didn't always make things as adeptly as they do now. But that changes a bit with the second film, The Human Tornado. And I'm going to just play some sounds from that now and then talk a bit more about it after you hear the radio spot that Rudy Ray Moore did to advertise The Human Tornado.
Watch out, mister. Here comes the twister.
This is Rudy Ray Moore.
Yes, I'm the Human Tornado. I chain down thunder and handcuff lightning. I'm so damn strong, it's sometimes frightening. I grabbed a star traveling a million miles a minute and slowed it down to the state speed limit. Yes, I'm the Human Tornado. Spinning, grinning, and sinning. I used an earthquake to mix my milkshake. I eat an avalanche when I want ice cream. I punched a hurricane and made it a breeze. I swallowed an iceberg and didn't freeze. The Human Tornado. Flinging cash and talking trash. Beamy, delayed, relayed, mislaid, and parlayed. Jump, dump, bumped, and mugwump. The Human Tornado! Rated R! Under 17, not admitted without a parent or a note from your jailer.
As you can see, Rudy Moore was a very quiet and unassuming sort of guy. And I think the Human Tornado has a lot more going for it than the original film. I think Rudy Ray Moore is more comfortable in front of the camera. I think he comes across... he lets himself be himself a lot more than in the first one, where there were times when he really wasn't comfortable with dialogue scenes and things like that. But in the second one, he kind of embraces the character and embraces his own nature, and he does seem more at ease. I'll just go through a little bit of a synopsis for the film. Dolomite returns in this loosely related semi-sequel featuring a somewhat more dynamic and out-there script. Sheriff Bentley, played by J.B. Barron, catches Dolomite in bed with his wife. The wife says, "He made me do it," and Dolomite says, "Bitch, are you for real?" She's shot and Dolomite escapes by rolling butt naked with clothes in his hand down a hill to his car. Dolomite and his three buddies, Bo, played by Ernie Hudson from Ghostbusters, Doug and Jimmy, kidnap a homosexual who's very excited about the situation and drive his car out to California. Dolomite soon learns that Calavetti, Herb Graham, has kidnapped his friends Java and TC, who were two of the girls who work for Queen Bee. Calavetti is forcing Queen Bee and her girls to work at his club. Pete Blakely, Jerry Jones again, is assigned to catch the Dolomite for Sheriff Bentley, who has followed him out to California. Disguised as a nerdy art salesman named Francot Delmonico Nicodemus, Dolomite literally fucks the whereabouts of TC and Java out of the nymphomaniac Mrs. Calavetti, played by Barbara Girl. And the girls are rescued and they arrive at Calavetti's party where the rest of the gang is already busy kicking ass. Calavetti is taken by Dolomite to the torture chamber for a taste of his own medicine, but Dolomite is followed by Bentley and things come to a head. Yeah, this one's a lot more fun. I think they embrace the silliness and the script is a lot more out there. There are some weird scenes where the girls who are kidnapped by Calavetti's people are locked up in a dungeon with what looks like an old witch lady. Dolomite himself is a lot more out there as a character. Rudy Ray Moore kind of embraces the fact that he is a really shit martial artist and just goes to town with that concept and turns it into high comedy. And as it says on the webpage, there are no boom microphones visible this time or in any of the later films. And, of course, the rhythmic dialogue of Rudy Ray Moore and his comedy routines are incorporated into the bits that Dolomite does in this film, particularly the sex scene with Mrs. Calavetti, where basically they totally destroy the room. Even the ceiling comes down and the lighting shorts out and the walls and the bed races around the room in a way not even seen in The Exorcist. It makes the bed bouncing up and down in The Exorcist look like a mildly vibrating hotel bed. But this film is a lot more fun. Again, it doesn't have the pacing of a modern film. It doesn't pretend to be what it's not. It's an exploitation film. It's fully acknowledged. There is a little bit with the gay guy that they kidnap and take to California where you think, okay, they're going to go into really kind of sexist, homophobic areas here. But then they get to California and they give the guy all the money they've got, $66, and just say, yeah, sorry we kidnapped you and sorry we brought you to California. He goes, I'm fine with that. Look at all the cute guys around here. It's not, it doesn't go into those areas like, and also they've got more nudity in it, which is something I always appreciate in a 1970s exploitation movie. I don't really think you can get too much nudity in those sort of films. Which reminds me of something I've got to tell you later about a recent film I saw, but I'll leave that for later on. Anyway, see The Human Tornado, see Dolomite. It'll probably take you a couple of viewings if you're not familiar with the material to really get into it. But I think it's also one of those films that kind of goes with the Mystery Science Theater 3000 kind of approach, where you get a few people in, you get a few munchies, you get a few beers in, and just have a bit of fun watching it with friends. It's very much one of those films that benefits a lot from that. I would recommend to anybody who's into blaxploitation to see it. A lot of blaxploitation movies are now coming out on DVD as well, so you do have the opportunity there to grab a number of them and really get familiar with the genre. I think that in a lot of ways the 1970s were an incredibly interesting and transitional time in cinema. There were a few dead ends, a few false starts, there were some bits that we don't want to revisit, but in general people were looking at other ways of telling stories and also more mature ways. The dialogue was more full of swearing, as dialogue tends to be in the real world, particularly in areas of criminality. And the nudity was more full on, and you could actually explicitly state things which were only very lightly suggested. Films from earlier eras, early 60s, 50s, 40s, you could only imply certain things in those films, which can be explicitly stated in later movies. And I think the 1970s is where that kind of started coming out. And I do like low-budget filmmaking. I don't expect it to be perfect. I don't expect low-budget films to be as carefully crafted and as professionally crafted as a big-budget studio film, whether Hollywood, Bollywood, or Europe, or even Australia. But I do like that rawness to it. I do like the fact that people are trying to do something and don't quite have it down pat on how they're going to do it. It's one of the reasons why I enjoy, when I am able to, going to the Melbourne Underground Film Festival. There are movie makers there that are telling stories that are totally non-commercial. They're not uninteresting, but there's really not a good market for, say, a 25 or 30-minute movie to be shown. Yet people are making them and showing them and learning their craft while they're doing it. And we should only encourage that. We don't know what's going to come out of it. I mean, a lot of movies are going online, and that's starting to become a venue for these sort of films. There are films that are going to be shot. There are films that are being shot specifically for being shown on mobile platforms, iPods and mobile phones and things like that. If we had had those technologies in the 1970s, I don't doubt for a second that we would have had 8-minute blaxploitation movies showing on iPhones. So, I'm not going to talk too much more about Rudy Ray Moore. Check out his website, rudyraymoore.com. Check out the movies. Let me know what you think of them. I know in particular, one of our listeners, Kyle Nipp, is really into Rudy Ray Moore, and he's surprised that anybody else knows who he is. But check him out. Add him to your pantheon of weird and wonderful filmmakers of the past. And let me know what you think when you have seen it and have embraced the idiosyncrasies of Rudy Ray Moore. I'm just going to take a little bit of a break now, and then I'll get back into the final film, Black Shampoo.
Meet Mr. Jonathan. Behind the wheel, he's got the feel. This dud is no dud. He's bad. He's mean. He's a loving machine. He's the height of fashion, the peak of passion. Sends gangsters crashing and women thrashing. Black Shampoo. He's got the touch they love so much.
You tell Mr. Jonathan that I left. If he won't do me, nobody will.
Does Mr. Jonathan make house calls?
Hello, lady. Artie's taking good care of all of you?
Artie just didn't have the equipment you have.
He gives each pet a wash and set. Men can't get him off their backs. Women can't get him out of their hair.
Jonathan.
Hello, Mr. Jonathan.
This is our new receptionist. Do you like her?
Wonderful, wonderful.
Oh, God, she'll never drown.
Well, I told you to watch who you're in it to, too, Nanda.
Hand me that thing. Hang him down. I'm going to give you the thrill of your lifetime.
Don't give him no sass or he'll kick your ass. A woman entices. A chainsaw slices. He's mad. He's mean. He's a killing machine. Let him give you a black shampoo. Black Shampoo.
A Graydon Clark production starring John Daniels and Tanya Boyd.
You got to love a trailer like that. If you're into movies the way I am, that kind of a trailer just makes you want to see the film. I mean, it's not like these days when all the movies you see are like, in a world where orangutans are sex slaves. You know, that kind of stuff. We don't, these earlier ones just have a kick-ass attitude even in the trailers, and I love that. Anyway, on to Black Shampoo. I'll give you the plot. John Daniels plays Jonathan Knight, the owner of Mr. Jonathan's, the most successful hair salon for women on the Sunset Strip. His reputation as a lover has become so awesome that he's sought after almost as much in that capacity as he is in his experience as a hairstylist. Everything is cool with Jonathan until he messes with the mob in an effort to protect his young, attractive receptionist, played by Tanya Boyd, from her former boss. Action explodes when the loving machine becomes a killing machine. Jonathan, chainsaw in hand, gets down to the get down on the vicious mob gang that wrecks his shop and kidnaps his woman. So that's basically it. Black Shampoo is one of the Black Now movies. Now, there are a whole bunch of movies made in the 1970s, exploitation films that had black and then a noun. There was Black Caesar, Black Fist, the Black Gestapo, the Black Godfather, Black Mama White Mama, Black Samson, Black Samurai, the Black Six, Black Snake, Blackenstein, Blackula. A lot of these were black versions or reimaginings of classic films or movies previously made with white casts. Graydon Clark was the director of 1976's Black Shampoo, and it's one of the few movies I know which effectively combines hairdressing, soft porn, sex, and chainsaw killings of mafia goons. Not many films do that, and this one does. Like the other Black Now movies, it's a redo of a white film, Warren Beatty's Shampoo, where the hairstylist screws his clientele and gets involved in relationships and confuses things. The Beatty movie was a Romana Clay kind of thing, portraying the early careers of both Jay Sebring, who was one of the people killed when the Manson family attacked Sharon Tate, and the film producer, formerly hairdresser John Peters, who went on to produce films like Barbara Streisand's remake of A Star Is Born, and Tango and Cash and Superman Returns. But Blanket Shampoo doesn't really follow. It's not a story about John Peters. It has great-looking women in it for a start. Tanya Boyd as Brenda, the receptionist. It was a stunningly attractive woman, and still is, from what I can see on the web. And it's also, she's a fine actress, so that gives an extra bit to what she does in the film. In a sense, it's like she's in a different movie than everybody else, because she's portraying things a lot more realistically than a lot of the actors. And John Daniels, who plays Mr. Jonathan, the scissor-wielding stud, is never going to be going up against Philip Seymour Hoffman for any acting awards. He does have a presence, and he is, in the film, an attractive guy, but not really a good actor at all. That's not necessarily a shortcoming for the movie. You can tell from looking at the film that the budget wasn't enormous, and there was a lot of filming around Sunset Strip and external shots, and the set pieces in sets built, for instance, the hairdressing studio, show the limitations of the budget. They just didn't have a lot of money to play around with in making this film. And but the thing that I found the most surprising is how erotic some of the sex scenes were. They're actually filmed with a lot of care and with a lot of sensitivity to them. They're not over the top in any way, and I think that the lovemaking scenes, they try to portray them as realistically as possible. One of the virtues the film has is the fact that the cinematographer Dean Cundey went on to win an Oscar for Who Framed Roger Rabbit as a cinematographer, and I know that the guys over at The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema are really fond of the works of Dean Cundey. They just love the cinematography for some reason. He's one of those movie makers that they really focused on and obsess about. But I do have a few problems with this film, one of which is they have a tender, loving sex scene, which is pretty hot for a softcore one, between Mr. Jonathan and Brenda, and they immediately cut to the scene where Artie, the gay hairdresser who works in the salon, is tortured by having a hot curling iron shoved up his ass by mafia goons. It's going from a soft, interesting sex scene to a guy getting raped with a curling iron. You need to put something in between those two scenes, even if it's just like an establishing shot or something like that. Don't take us from soft porn, she's nice, to ouch. It just fucks with your head. Please, movie makers, don't do that. Now, also, the bits where Mr. Jonathan and Brenda fleeing the mafia goons hide out in his house in the hills, like a country shack he's got, and they're followed by the mafia guys, and the only weapon that Mr. Jonathan can find is a chainsaw. Here's a tip for movie makers and for people being chased by mafia goons. A chainsaw is not a stealth weapon. Given the need and the choice, I'd definitely go a machete over a chainsaw. I'd probably put a wrist loop around the machete as well, kind of like you do with a Nintendo Wii remote when you're swinging it around. I don't want to lose the weapon. A chainsaw has a psychological advantage, absolutely. People are terrified of chainsaws being wielded by angry people in their proximity. But you're not going to sneak up with anybody on anybody while you've got a two-stroke motor roaring in your hands. It's just not going to work. I still think a machete would be better. It'll get the job done. And yes, it's a little bit easier to do with a chainsaw, but don't be lazy. Swing your arm. I think the chainsaw in this film, basically, to summarize that, is a bit of a silly way of going about it. Machete, much better. Even a stick with a nail through it is better than a chainsaw in these kind of situations. People are going to be alert to the fact you're sneaking up behind them if the engine's revving. Before you roll your eyes and totally scribble this film off your list, see it. It's interesting. It's the cinematography is good. There's some surprising sex scenes in it. The music is quite good too. I mean, the soundtrack album to Black Shampoo is, while it's not right up there with Curtis Mayfield and Isaac Hayes, is a perfectly respectable soundtrack, and it is available out there. If you look around, you'll find it. But I've played it a few times in the background while I've been doing other things around the place, and it works really well as a soundtrack. Now, I'll play you a little bit of the soundtrack before I summarize the second anniversary Paleo Cinema and get into it, but I'll just play you a bit of the soundtrack to show you what I mean about this film. See what I mean about certain kinds of soundtrack music really typifying an era in cinema? I mean, that could not be anything but the 1970s and a not too large budget exploitation movie of some kind. It's got that twang guitar thing happening there. It's just a positive way. And I really enjoy that in some of my soundtrack listening, where a movie's music really gives it a time and place in a big way. Okay, moving on to the end of the thing. I'd like to really thank everybody for their support over the last 2 years of Paleo Cinema. There have been times when it's been harder to do than others. There have been times when it ran so smoothly I was incredibly surprised. But I do appreciate the feedback. I do appreciate how many people are downloading it. I am able to look at the statistics, and I do so on a regular basis. And I'm still blown away by how many people actually enjoy what I'm doing. And the graph is still going upwards. We're still increasing in our listenership here, and thank you very much for that. It's done partly for me, but it's also done to entertain people out there, so I do appreciate that. Again, I'm surprised by where people are listening to this podcast at. People in Istanbul and in Thailand and in Indonesia are listening to Paleo Cinema just like the rest of us. And I do get a lot of goodwill from that. So thank you very much for listening. Even if you never send me an email, never send me a letter, I do enjoy the fact that I've got an audience out there and that there are people who enjoy movies as much as I do. So that's about it for this time. I'll throw a little bit of music at the end of the podcast. I think I'll do the whole theme music from Human Tornado this time around. I've got a very good mix of it that I picked up very recently. So thanks for that. Again, the email address is kultguru@gmail.com. The website is paleo-cinema.blogspot.com. Thanks for listening, and I'll be back in 3 weeks doing something entirely different from the movies this time around. Okay, take it easy. Enjoy. Oh, that's what I was going to say before you go. Movie recommendation, modern movie. The Boat That Rocked. Richard Curtis's film starring Philip Seymour Hoffman, Nick Frost, no relation, and Bill Nye. See that movie, if only for a couple of things. One, the soundtrack kicks ass. Two, the comedy ensemble is fantastic. And three, there is one brief scene where an entire ship's hull full of naked women are surrounding one guy. I don't think I've ever seen so many naked women outside of a Spencer Tunick documentary in my life, even more than Salon Kitty. It is an awesome blanket of female flesh. Now, I know I'm talking horny this time around this podcast, but I was doing blaxploitation. If you've seen The Boat That Rocked, you'll know the scene that I mean. If you haven't seen it, see it. It's mind-boggling. And also the film is very funny, very touching, and a lot of fun. So that's about it. Catch you later.
you told the cross-eyed bow-legged son of a gun's a messing with me. I've been known to rise up, but I'll cool down later. Have the band go to school, I'm the human tornado.
He's a human tornado.
I picked up the rock, killed the giant Goliath. I put those Nero to set the road on fire. I whooped the lion, elephants and lots of rascals and geese. I don't want no dilapidated sea-stopping, pigeon-toed, cross-eyed, bow-legged son of a gun.
Young ladies the other night, baby, and I couldn't get ready for her so quick. You know what I did? I stuck one finger up in there. She said, oh, daddy. Oh, that feel good. Stick a little bit further up in there. I got a little bit further up in there. She said, oh, daddy, your ring is hurting. I said, that ain't none of my ring. That's my watch, bitch.